Welcome to the Science of Fitness podcast, where we aim to inspire you to live a healthier and more fulfilling life as we share evidence and anecdotes on all things relating to health, fitness, performance, business, and wellness. G'day everybody and welcome to the Science of Fitness podcast. And this is the first of a new series in which we're going to be running here in season two called the Solo Series. And essentially it'll be either myself or one of our team sitting and communicating a topic that we're particularly interested in, passionate about, maybe researching. And in light of the running mechanics workshop that we're hosting in the next couple of weeks at both our locations, I thought why not sit down and dive into some details involved in running. So running is one of the easiest and most popular forms of cardio training. And of late, particularly with the spike back out of COVID, it's become a really sort of social thing that everyone's doing in terms of joining social run clubs, getting out and running with mates, and actually getting involved in running as a general activity. And we're all for it. The biggest thing that we pride ourselves on at Science of Fitness is a high quality program, but driven behind a community of people that connect. And exercise for us is one of the best tools that you can use to connect with people. And in fact, we think as the world progresses, people are going to lean on exercise more and more as a social connection, just as much as the health benefits that typically come from it. And so diving into the details of running and what the mechanics that really drive effective running are, we sort of want to address two things. First and foremost, if running has hurt you in the past, or if it has caused you any injuries, or you're currently navigating running with an injury, we want to dive into some details as to what might be going on there. And then secondly, the more you run and the more you enjoy it, you probably want to get a little bit better at running and you want to improve your running efficiency. Coincidentally, when we solve for one, we tend to solve for the other. And so be it running efficiency or running economy, we can also then solve for running injury and vice versa. And so a little bit of details when it comes to running and what it does. Approximately 56% of recreational runners and as many as 90% of those training for a marathon sustain a running-related injury each year. And that is quite a significant statistic, particularly for those that are thinking of getting involved but are not really keen on injuring themselves. And so if running is so highly related with injury and statistically is proven to cause so much injury, why do it at all? Well, other side of the coin, one, if you're joining a social run club, it's a hell of an enjoyable activity. And nothing feels quite as good as a runner's high if you've ever experienced it. So doing a 3K, a 5K, a 10K, a half marathon with a group of mates, it actually feels amazing afterwards because of the biochemical and biomechanical sort of stresses and processes and the due diligence that comes with it. It gives you that real sense of self-worth, improving not only your social wellness, not only your physical wellness because you're fitter and a little bit stronger, but your mental wellness because of all those factors coinciding. And we lean on a principle that I sort of like to refer to as a triangle. You've got your biochemical processes, and that's the nutritional, breathing, chemical sort of things that happen when you exercise. You've got your mechanical processes, and that's the physics and the strength and the application of your strength training and running. And then you've got the neuro or the neuropsycho processes, which sort of sit at the very top. If you lean in and influence the mechanical processes, get a little bit stronger, improve your mobility, move a little bit better, it's going to have your neurological processes feeling a little bit better. So all of a sudden, mentally, you're feeling a little bit more confident in your body. You're feeling a little bit more confident in yourself because you've adhered to maybe a program, a strength program, and it's been quite challenging, but you've stuck at it. And then that then coincides with you making better decisions nutritionally. It coincides with you getting better quality sleep, which then improves that chemical aspect. And so each one can positively influence the other, just as it can negatively influence the other. And typically when people experience injuries on the mechanical end, they then have this neurological, psychological sort of downward spiral and beat themselves up and feel a little bit almost depressed, if you will. And likewise, then the biochemical stress element comes into it with regard to spikes in cortisol and then sort of changes in sleep patterns. And so it can spiral downward. And so we're really looking at solving the problem holistically. And before we throw a Band-Aid on a injury diagnosis or whatever it might be, we want to dive into what might be causing the injury or in, you know, the performance case, the inefficiency. And so that's really what we're looking to address. And to keep today light and sort of short and digestible for the average person out there, There's a couple of things that are really critical for effective running. And the number one thing that most people don't quite understand is being strong is essential to run well. And what do I mean by being strong? Well, I'm not talking about your muscles and taking your shirt off and being ripped and lifting a heavy, heavy weight. Being strong when it comes to running is actually being able to recruit the necessary muscle to manage or generate the necessary force for that movement. In the case of running, you spend a lot of time on a single leg, landing, absorbing impact, and then generating force as that stride swings through. And so understanding that a specific set of muscles have to play a specific set of roles in the management of that landing, absorbing, and then generating of the force is where we can start to lean into the definition of strength. And so when it comes to strength training for running, you need to really be considering a couple of key components. First and foremost, there's a thing out there in the sort of literature and in the clinical world, particularly around the physiotherapy, of a contralateral pelvic drop or a Trendelenburg. And hopefully we can get an image up here if you want to explore that via the video links. The contralateral pelvic drop is almost a marker for the likelihood of injury. And some of the literature around it is quite significant. As far as for every 1 degree of increase in contralateral pelvic drop or Trendelenburg-like pattern, there is an 80% increase in the odds of being classified as injured. So it's a correlation, yes, it's not a cause, but generally when people have an overuse injury, they've got a compromise in their pelvic mechanics, which then downstream compromises the hip, the knee, and the ankle mechanics, ultimately causing a breakdown in the movement. So to envision what this might be, if you're not watching this and you can't quite see the image, if you take your hands and hold the two bony parts of the front of your hips, if you just tilt one side down to an edge and then the other side down to an edge, your pelvis can rock side to side. Now that becomes problematic when you're running if the lifting leg, the leg that's in the air, is up in the air and your pelvis drops to that flexed knee side, the foot that's in the air. That's your Trendelenburg pattern, your contralateral pelvic drop. And that becomes an issue because you can't then generate the force off the foot that's on the floor, particularly from the hip of the leg that's on the floor. And so that then washes up into all sorts of compensatory patterns. You might overuse your hamstring, your groin. You might track your knee a little bit funny and then the patella gets put under more stress. Maybe your calf has to do a lot more work and you get some overuse injuries in your Achilles tendon. Whatever it might be, the root of evil tends to come back to the stability in which you can hold your pelvis with. So how do we solve for this? Well, there's sort of two things to think about. First and foremost, you need to consider your abdomen and your abdominals and what their role is in terms of controlling your pelvic position. If you tuck your tail under or sort of flex your lumbar spine, your belly button will naturally draw in. The bony parts in the front of that pelvis will tuck towards you. And you'll actually feel your abdomen contract. So your abdominals play a really important role in managing where your pelvis is. Inversely, if you arch your lower back, your belly pushes out, your lumbar extensors, the back muscles squeeze, and you can actually feel that. Those bony parts in the front of your hips tilt forward. So your pelvis can rock forward and rock backwards. And so our abdomen play a really specific role in managing that. When we're running, we don't want any forward or backward rocking first. And so we need to think about pulling our spine really long, having our belly button drawn in. And a long spine is a cue you'll hear all the time if you've done any form of athletics or athletics coaching. Get tall, get tall, get tall, is what a coach would say. Naturally, that narrows our waist, our abdomen contract, and not squeezing tense, but just a gentle contraction, and they hold our pelvis in place, which is critical to prevent that forward and backwards motion. The second thing that happens in our abs is our muscles, called our obliques, work across our body. And there's theories around there from what's called fascial lines or fascial slings. And the oblique sling is a theory that runs from, let's say, the right-hand side, almost underneath your shoulder blade, across your abdomen to the left-hand hip. And if you think left knee flexes up, right arm flexes up. And that's why we move opposite arm and leg when we run. And so there's that degree of contraction to provide stability in the pelvis, and that then stops the side-to-side action. And so if we want to think about getting better control of our pelvis at the abdominal and lumbar spine control, we need to be doing exercises such as your planks, your basic abdominal crunches, your cat-cow type movements in your warm-ups, and have a really clear understanding of what it means to flex the spine and manage the lumbar spine. And then second to that, we need to be really clear as to what the role of our obliques are, those muscles on the side of our body, both external and internal. And there's two things we can think about. One, doing your side planks and holding in what's called an isometric position, keeping still. And then the second thing we can think about is resisting rotation. So exercises like your bird dogs or controlled bear crawl patterns really give us a good understanding as to, do these oblique muscles working across the system keep the pelvis and the spine still? Can we do that in a controlled environment in the gym? And so that when we turn around and jump onto the floor, we can actually then manage our running on the floor, we can manage our pelvic positions. And so that's going to give you a really good idea as to how we keep the spine in check and the pelvis in check with our abdomen. We then think down to the lower parts and the lower limbs, our hips in particular. That's when we can get an understanding of what muscles in our hips and our legs also prevent the Trendelenburg contralateral pelvic tilt pattern. And so this is where glutes become critical. And you, at some point, have suffered a running-related injury or an overuse injury, you've probably been told you need to get stronger glutes. And that is dead right. There's muscles in your glutes that sit, not just your glute max, the big meaty glute muscle, but just above them, there's your glute med and min. And more importantly, below all of those, you've got your deep hip external rotators. And those muscles collectively work together to not only generate what's called hip extension, so the propulsion force forward, but external rotation in terms of a twisting of the femur as you propel yourself forward. Now, when your glutes aren't doing their job, they will not contract as well, which means that pelvis is going to then drop out. And if you sort of think about how someone can tilt their pelvis out, and Instagram models might do it, their pelvis will roll out and it sort of changes the angle and their thigh turns in. We want the opposite of that to happen when we're running. And so if you want to feel this in real time, stand up and hold onto your hips. You're going to stand on a single leg and you're just going to hitch your pelvis up to the side of the leg that's floating. So you lift up, let's say your right knee, you're standing on a straight left leg, and then just tilt your pelvis up to the right as that right knee floats up. And immediately you're going to be mimicking your running gait in a very controlled fashion. But more importantly, you'll feel the glute and the hip extension on that left-hand side just hitch and hold. And that's really where you start to, in a controlled environment, again, like at the gym or at home, you get a map of where your hips are and where your pelvis is. So if you take the abdominal work that we've talked about, plus a bit of that hip work in terms of feeling that glute hitch and hold and squeeze and propel that hip forward into extension, when you go out and run, you want to think about the same mechanics and start really basically with, you know, 50 to 100 meter efforts in which your brain can concentrate. Don't try and run 5K and stay concentrated on the mechanics. And just be conscious about your hip positions. If you want to strip it back a little bit more, simple A-skip and marching patterns are really straightforward to put your hands on your hips and notice, do your hands move side to side or do they stay nice and square? And that really then brings us to our strength exercises. Because if I want to get really strong to be able to handle 10,000, 20,000 steps on a long run, well, I need to be able to have the muscle endurance in order to do so. So if I turn around to the gym and I'm doing my squat, I need to think about, okay, can I organize my pelvis as I discussed before with the abdominal work, sink and drive out of that position? And then second to that, can I actually do that sort of work on a single leg? And a lot of people fall short when it comes to strength training and its relationship to running is they forget that we need to be strong on one leg to run well, because at no point in our running mechanic do we have 2 feet on the floor. And if you do, you're not running, or you're running really, really slowly. So understanding that we need to be strong on one leg is a critical component of your strength training. And if you are doing strength training for running and you don't have any loaded single leg exercises, I highly recommend you put something in as fast as possible. Some variations include a single leg reverse lunge and think your start and finish position can be up on one leg with that knee flexed. Your Bulgarian split squats, your box step ups, and there's so many more variations that you can do. But getting a bit of load and then generating those movements down to full range and back out is going to help your brain and your body connect and the muscles develop strength and strength endurance and more importantly, the awareness of the right patterning from a hip extension, lumbopelvic control, to then actually go out and run without any stress or too much load going where we don't want it to go. And that really starts to bring in that strength element when it comes to your training. You don't need to be breaking records with your squat. You don't need to be doing PBs with your lunges if you want to be an effective runner. In fact, it's very hard to do both, and it's almost redundant. But knowing that you have to have a degree of strength to be able to run really well is something that everybody that wants to run seriously and wants to prevent injury when they're running needs to be considering and needs to be applying. And that sort of hopefully gives you a map or an idea of what we mean by strength training in relation to running. And the second thing to think about for those that want to get a little bit more efficient and also, again, reduce impact and reduce risk of injury is our stride rate and foot placement or foot strike pattern. And again, there's a ton of information out there. And once you sort of open the can of worms, it can be terribly overwhelming. I'm going to try and simplify it down to one key point today. And that is simply not worrying too much about your foot strike or your cadence, your stride rate. And so if we think about cadence for a second, typically people sit between 170 and 190 sort of steps per minute. And understanding what that means and how much faster that'll make you go or slower will make you go isn't that essential, because people that are 6 foot plus tall are going to have a lower stride rate because they can take longer strides. People that are shorter are going to have a higher stride rate. So we can almost park that on the side if you're a sort of recreational runner. If you're elite, we might need to go into the details. It depends. And then likewise, when it comes to your foot strike patterns, there's three ways in which our foot can be determined in terms of its strike pattern. The first one, and the most common one we'll see, is a heel strike. So traditionally just landing with your heel. The second one is your midfoot strike pattern. So that's sort of landing with a somewhat flat foot. And then the third one is a forefoot strike pattern. And so which one of those is correct? Which one should you be doing? Modern footwear is designed with heavy cushioning. And so that generally, based on the literature, promotes a heel strike pattern because it's not going to hurt us. If you take your shoe off, you're going to land into a foot strike, a forefoot strike or a midfoot strike pattern, because heel first on bitumen doesn't feel good. Now, I sat in the forefoot midfoot strike pattern because it made evolutionary sense for a very long time. In fact, I ran holes into the undersole of my shoe because I was so proud about my forefoot strike. What I didn't consider, and this is a really important point, is what's called oscillation, the up and down movement in which we generate when we run. And so if we want to maximize our efficiency and minimize our impact, we want to do two things. First and foremost, we don't want to be moving up and down because that's inefficient. We want to be moving forward. And then the second thing we want to be doing is reducing the impact. And that then determines where our foot lands in reference to our center of mass. So when it comes to your foot strike, again, it doesn't really matter which one you do. What matters is where your center of mass is in reference to when your foot lands, not how your foot lands. And so when you think about that a little bit detailed, it's actually about the load and the management of the angle of your shin and therefore your trunk and your foot. And so as you listen to this, if you have the opportunity to stand up and lean onto the front of your foot, lean at the ankle, not at the hip. You hinge at the ankle, not at the hip. You'll feel the weight distribute across your whole foot. So your toes will press down, your whole foot would spread wide. And then more importantly, you'd actually feel this sort of need to almost fall forward and propel yourself forward. That's the main thing we want to be thinking about when we are running. Not necessarily heel, foot, cadence, etc. If we lean forward slightly, going back to the cadence area, we're going to take a few more steps per minute naturally. The second thing, if we lean forward more naturally, is where our foot lands, be it heel, forefoot, or midfoot, is going to then propel us forward very quickly and actually help us generate that forward force as opposed to the vertical force. And so if you are leaning backwards, contrary to the opposite to what I'm saying, what's going to happen is your foot's going to land out in front of you. And when your foot lands out in front of you, it's going to apply what is called a breaking force. And for those of you that did physics in high school or maybe even earlier than that, you might have come across a couple of theories of motion thanks to our friend Isaac Newton. And the biggest thing that Newton's third law in terms of what he talks about with regard to every action has an equal and opposite reaction is how it applies to the way we run. So if I'm leaning backwards and my foot is landing out in front of me, the equal and opposite reaction is going to run straight back up that limb through my body and apply a braking force, meaning it's going to be a less efficient, higher impact running mechanic or running gait. Versus if I'm leaning forward slightly, my foot's not going to land out in front of me, it's going to land underneath me. And in the quick moment in time in which my momentum passes forward, by the time I'm pushing off the floor, the propulsive force is actually going to be forward, not upward. And there's going to be a minimization of the braking forces, which are sort of inevitable when we run thanks to gravity and everything else. And we want to think about sort of three things. Minimize the braking force, minimize the oscillation, the up and down traveling of the way we run, and then most importantly, maximize that forward propulsion. And so when we sort of take the forward lean, come back to the strength and the lumbopelvic control that we talked about, we then can think about running in two ways. First of all, if I'm looking side on from someone, I'm looking at their forward lean and how that influences where their foot strikes. And then second to that, if I'm looking front on or from behind with someone, I'm looking at their pelvis and does it shift side to side or does it stay nice and still and their belly button drawn in slightly, not moving forward and backwards. If we can just take our eyes and take our mind to those two main points, you're immediately going to feel an effect not only on the impact and therefore the potential injury-related thing that you're feeling, but more importantly, the efficiency. You're going to run lighter, you're going to run naturally faster, and you're actually going to enjoy it more, allowing you to get more out of running, even as you are going with how it influences all the other factors of life, as I sort of spoke about at the beginning. So two main things. Are you leaning forward at the ankle? And then are you controlling your pelvic position with a bit of abdominal, a bit of glute strength? And then are you getting the most out of your running? And it really is quite simple once you think about just two points. As you develop, as you get stronger, as you run faster, there's plenty of nuances with footwear and cadence and what strength and tempo and all that sort of thing. But for the recreational runner, the runner that wants to get the most out of it and just enjoy it for what it is, I highly recommend sticking to those two points. Obviously, if you have any questions or thoughts or comments, we'd love to hear them. Running is such an enjoyable, easy access mode of exercise, and we're all for it. So by all means, get in touch and let's get the most out of our running. Thanks for listening to today's episode. For more regular insights into SOF, be sure to check us out on Instagram or Facebook, or visit our website at scienceoffitness.com.au. Once again, we thank you for tuning in to the Science of Fitness podcast.